Welcome to the podcast series for AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology. I'm your host, Kara Hansel-Kehan. Today, we'll discuss the article by Kim et al. Titled, Secondary SR Calcium Release and Arrhythmia Risk in Bradycardia. This article published online January 11th, 2013. My guests today are Associate Editor Igor Efimov, Lead Author Guy Salama, and Expert Stephen Polzing. Let's get started.
Once again, welcome to our podcast, and we're discussing today a new paper which investigated calcium release and repolarization abnormalities due to bradycardia. As one would expect, bradycardia prolongs action potential duration. However, what Dr. Salama and his group has discovered is that such prolongation also leads to instability of calcium and spontaneous calcium release precipitating in delayed after depolarizations and arrhythmia. And now I would like to invite Dr. Salama, the correspondent author on this paper, to describe main results, principal points of this paper, and bring the take-home message.
The first thing I'd like to say is that we are doing studies in an area where there has been a tremendous amount of research, which is essentially how intracellular calcium can affect cardiac electrophysiology, and through some form of calcium voltage coupling be the initial source of arrhythmia. A lot of studies have happened in the intact heart, and only more recently has there been studies at the subcellular level where people have looked at calcium within a cell and how that couples across cell to cell and in an intact heart. So these studies use confocal imaging, which in a way gives you great 3D resolution, but has other limitation in terms of spatial delays and temporal quality of the signals. Here, what we've done is combine a non-confocal subcellular imaging of calcium and at the same time looked at intact heart calcium waves. So in this case, what we really try to address is whether or not spontaneous release of calcium from calcium release units can somehow synchronize at the subcellular level and from cell to cell to be powerful enough to elicit an arrhythmia. And we show here that in a rabbit, in just bradycardia, in a completely normal, relatively healthy organ, there is synchronization at the cellular level and intercellular level to be essentially the central mechanism that can elicit an arrhythmia.
Thank you, Guy, for this wonderful introduction and a great take-home message. And now I would like to invite our expert, Steve Polzing, who published along the same line of inquiry, and please ask very tough questions.
So, Guy, wonderful study, and a few questions for you. Your discussion of the mechanism I thought was very interesting, and you suggest that sarcoplasmic reticular load as a function of pacing rate may actually be bell-shaped. So both at extremely high and extremely low pacing rates, both cause potentially sarcoplasmic reticulum calcium overload, whereas I think you're suggesting normal pacing is associated with some nominal value. I was wondering if you could comment a little more on that than you did in the discussion.
Yes, that's indeed a very good point. There's a great deal of studies looking at fast pacing. And with fast pacing, you can argue that there's more and more action potentials per unit time, say per minute, and a greater influx of calcium. So the system has to adapt, and the adaptation occurs through a shortening of the action potential duration and essentially a calcium-mediated inhibition of the amplitude of the calcium current. Well, in bradycardia, we also have calcium overload. And it comes about from a slightly different mechanism. In slow rates, you have action potential duration adapts, and you have a prolongation of the action potential duration. And as you prolong the action potential duration, calcium entry through the voltage-gated L-type calcium current occurs, and it is inactivated via a calcium-dependent mechanism, but also by a voltage-dependent mechanism. So the voltage-dependent inactivation essentially tells you there's going to be an influx of calcium during the whole time course of the plateau phase. It's not as large as the peak influx, but it's substantial. And so as you build up this calcium from beet to beet, you eventually accumulate more calcium in the sarcoplasmic reticulum than you're able to remove from the cell through the sodium-calcium exchanger. And so what happens is that during the diastolic phase, we start to see subcellular waves of calcium that are random in nature. And they spread, they propagate in some cells and not others, and they don't reach the level where they can elicit a strong depolarization of the membrane potential during the plateau phase. What happens in the systolic phase is that the more you have diastolic waves of calcium, the more you have a large secondary release of calcium in the plateau phase. And that part of this release is highly synchronous within the cell. And adjacent cells also show the same process of a secondary release of calcium. And then put together, what we show is that you're able to get a voltage depolarization substantial enough to propagate and initiate an arrhythmia.
So with regard to the randomness that you discussed, if the mechanism is you proposed, would you expect the time to secondary calcium release to correlate in some way to the pacing rate rather than, or in addition to, only finding an increase in the EAD amplitude?
What we find is that it's primarily dependent on the pacing rate. In other words, you can eliminate the secondary calcium release by simply accelerating a heart rate. And by changing to fast rates, it disappears. And as you go to slower rates in the range of 50 beats per minute, which is a cycle length of 1.2 seconds, you start to see substantial secondary release of calcium. And this is a gradual event. It requires that you hold the bradycardia for a good 30 seconds, and it gets bigger and bigger. So in other words, it shows the dynamic properties of this phenomenon. The reason why we wanted to look at the diastolic waves of calcium, we wanted to use this as evidence that overload of the sarcoplasmic reticulum was taking place. The more the load that we see in diastole, the more the amplitude of the secondary calcium release. And to us, that was an indirect evidence that SR calcium load was important for the secondary elevation of calcium in systole, and that perhaps it wasn't triggered by the L current, but was spontaneous release from internal stores of the sarcoplasmic reticulum.
Okay, to follow up on that, can you specifically speak to the takeoff time or the start of that secondary hump? It doesn't seem to change, only the amplitude changes. Why do you think that is?
Right, we started to look at that in essentially out of curiosity of exactly what regulates the secondary release of calcium. And the first thing we looked is, when does it occur? And it occurred about 184 milliseconds after the upstroke. And that was a fairly tight number. And so why that and not something else? And in effect, the two options that you gave us, that it's really controlled by the action potential and the initial trigger that started the upstroke and the first phase of calcium release, and or whether it's SR calcium load. And in a way, the two are related. You trigger the action potential through the normal pacing mechanism. You generate an upstroke. The first phase of calcium release occurs. And normally, the calcium reaches its peak and starts to fall down. But here, things are essentially going, in a dynamic sense, in the wrong way. You are not able to return calcium back to baseline. The cell's cytosolic levels of calcium remain high because of the long action potential duration. Now, the longer the action potential duration, the greater the calcium in the cytosol. And the sodium-calcium exchanger is now trying to pump this calcium out of the cell. Well, that also gives you a depolarization of the plateau potential. So you sort of have a positive feedback mechanism of more calcium in, more depolarization through NCX, more prolongation of action potential duration, And if you prolong the actual potential duration, you have more calcium entry through the ale current. And at a certain point, the load in the SR has reoccurred. And it probably occurs through essentially the circa 2. And circa 2 is distributed along the sarcomere, loading up the SR. And then this SR goes by a diffusional process along the sarcomere to the terminal cisterna. And then it's ready again to be potentially re-released. And this process takes about 184 milliseconds. And so this system essentially is dependent on the two things, both the load on the SR and the original trigger, which started the process.
As you're likely aware, we recently published data to suggest that modulating sodium channels plays a role in reducing arrhythmias under conditions of calcium overload, and specifically a low dose of tetrodotoxin, which did not change stimulation threshold or conduction velocity, was sufficient to attenuate spontaneous arrhythmias. So along with our other manuscripts, we're coming to the conclusion that large sodium influx is actually important to the mechanism of extra beat formation. And in your study, this present study, NaV1.5 is expressed to a greater extent in the right ventricular base, the area where the secondary release events preferentially occur. So what do you think the role sodium is playing in your arrhythmias?
This is a wonderful and very, very important question. In essence, we have started to look at all of the different theories of what prolongs the action potential duration during bradycardia. And we try to articulate this in the manuscript in as fairly a brief way as we could. And we might not have done justice to the sodium current and sodium load in the cell in bradycardia. But we did mention that the early studies argued for calcium-dependent inactivation of the Yale current. Then other studies implicated the sodium-calcium exchanger as being important to prolong action potential duration in bradycardia. And still other studies, fairly recent by Guo in heart rhythm, implicated INA as your studies have implicated INA. And so there are many ways in which you can manipulate calcium concentration in the cell and its balance between cytosolic calcium and SR calcium in the time frame of an action potential or a few action potentials. And so I think all of them are implicated and all of them can contribute to the secondary elevation of calcium release. And so indeed, I would suspect that even in the bradycardia experiments that we have performed here, we looked at K201 to inhibit RYR2 and block the secondary elevation of calcium. But we also have essentially a plethora of other contributing mechanisms, and certainly INA would be one of them. So it behooves on us to test others, such as a pure INA inhibitor, or maybe TTX, as you have done.
Thank you, Steve and Guy, for this wonderful discussion and really interesting data. However, I would like to bring another point to this discussion. So recently, we and others have shown very interesting gender differences in arrhythmogenesis in humans and in animal models. And of course, we all know that Guy Salama is one of the experts in gender differences with respect to remodeling and arrhythmogenesis. So I would like to invite you, Guy, to speculate on the possible gender differences in this particular phenomenon, which you discovered in the paper with spontaneous calcium release, and how women could be more vulnerable in bradycardia precipitated arrhythmias.
This is certainly a question that's very close to my heart. We have been very interested in understanding the difference between the female and the male heart, and in particular, why bradycardia in the presence of IKR blockade precipitates torsade de pointe and arrhythmias in the female heart with incredible, you know, almost 95-99% regularity in the female and virtually none in the male. And so we've discovered over the years that there's estrogen-mediated upregulation of the voltage-gated calcium channel and the sodium-calcium exchanger, and that this regulation and this higher expression occurs in the base of the heart and not at the apex or the endocardium. of the heart. And so this essentially now taking it into the clinical realm where patients with a heart block, where you have either a navy node that isn't properly functioning or a conduction system. The concern of the cardiologist is to maintain heart rate and to prevent polymorphic tachyarrhythmias that are triggered by the bradycardia. And in the patient population, this particular effect shows a great sex difference with a female patients being much more susceptible and vulnerable to these kinds of bradycardia-mediated arrhythmias. And so is the female heart also responding to estrogen the way the rabbit heart does? And so we've been looking at that, so sort of more a future studies, and we're starting to get some very interesting data in human ventricular tissues from male and female. These are normal, healthy ventricular muscles that were obtained from essentially patients whose hearts were somewhat damaged and couldn't be used for transplantation. And in these studies, we are finding that the human heart shows the same differences in CAV 1.2 alpha and CX, and that we can, in isolated cell, mediate the L current by adding estrogen and expressing a greater current. So in the female heart exposed to 1 nanomolar of estrogen, you have a 29% increase in current. So we think that we're onto something where what we see in the rabbit translates very well to the human heart.
Well, unfortunately, time is running out, and I would like to invite both our experts, Steve Polzink and the principal author, Gisa Lama, to bring the concluding remarks. And let us start with our expert, Dr. Steve Polzink.
Three portions of the manuscript that most excited me were that not all EADs and DADs occur in Purkinje fibers, regions of tissue that can exhibit this phenomenon. And now I think we need to readjust our thoughts on not just how many myocytes are required to create a propagated response, but what is the distribution of these spontaneously firing myocytes, as shown very nicely by these microscopic images by Guy. And then the last point, I think we might also want to think a little outside of the box concerning these secondary calcium release events, because they do occur on every beat with very precise timing. And these two observations suggest to me some type of timing mechanism or calcium clock, and potentially argues against a simple stochastic phenomenon.
Well, thank you, Steve. And now I would like to give the last word to the corresponding author of this wonderful paper, Dr. Gisa Lama.
Thank you. I think the last comments made by Steve are spot on. What this is leading us to is to start to ask more specifically how this synchronization occurs at the subcellular level. And it gives us now an opportunity to study that particular aspect. And it also raises the issue of intracellular synchronization. What mechanism is important to understand that adjacent cells are essentially releasing calcium through this process, and what synchronizes them? What is the communication? We think we can speculate on these mechanisms, but I think it's a great opportunity to now get actual measurements and evidence that is rather robust. And it also gives us unique opportunities to study what happens in heart failure. Is this kind of calcium mechanism operating in the failing heart, but in specific regions of the heart, not the infarct, but maybe the border zone or even the normal zone of a diseased heart? And so we certainly are aware that these studies are only the beginning, and opens us to investigate many other new areas.
Well, thank you, Guy. Thank you, Steve, for this wonderful discussion of a new paper published in the American Journal of Physiology, Heart and Circulatory Physiology. This concludes our podcast.
You've been listening to an AJP Heart and Circ podcast. For more podcasts, visit us online at ajpheart.physiology.org. Thank you.